Welcome to the What If podcast. In recent years, the concept of space tourism for commercial goals has become increasingly popular. And although the idea of going for a trip to the moon or a vacation to space may seem far-fetched, for ultimate rich geniuses, Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, these ideas may not be as unrealistic as it sounds to us. I even read recently that Elon Musk announced that he would launch a space trip for three ordinary citizens. Just imagine, going on a holiday to space. This just sounds so incredibly fictional for me. Now, these space trips are only reserved for the super rich, and mostly purely for pleasure. But what if these technologies could be used for a solution for humanity in a worst-case scenario? Therefore, what if, for some reason, we were able to colonize Mars due to these spacecraft technologies? So let's set a hypothetical scenario for this podcast. Imagine that the long-predicted apocalypse of the Earth has finally taken place and the Earth is inhabitable. The disastrous consequences of climate change have finally become the truth. Floods, droughts, hurricanes, tornadoes, fires, they have all become the new normal and have wiped out human society until almost none was left. Thus, in a desperate attempt to save humankind, human technology took a leap of faith and moved its last remaining population to Mars. Here we can start over and learn from the past and not repeat its mistakes. However, to do these, the so-called Martians decide that capitalism is one of the drivers for the unsustainable actions on Earth. And they also realize that the resource availability on Mars is scarce and should be used consciously. Therefore, and due to the fact that they will immediately die if they don't use the rare resources consciously, the Martians decide that this new society should be based 100% on circularity. So the new society needs to be built up from scratch and with a completely new way of conducting its society. Different management and social structures will need to be invented and put in place. The most urgent matter to tackle are the necessities to meet basic needs, such as production of food as well as shelter. Well, okay, that was quite a dramatic scenery, and let's hope it will never come true, but this scenario sets the perfect scene to discuss how we as humans could live on Mars in a 100% circular economy. Of course, I am no expert on both the situations on Mars and also the circular economy. However, I have invited four experts who will be able to provide us with information and interesting insights on how humanity will be able to achieve this. Well, that was quite a dramatic scenery, and let's hope that it will never come true. But this scenario sets the perfect scene to discuss how we as humans could live on Mars in a 100% circular economy. Of course, I am no expert on Mars, of both the situation of Mars and the principle of the circular economy. So, today I have invited four experts who will be able to provide us with information and interesting insights on how humanity could live on Mars. So, let's start off with the first one. Hi Juliette, welcome.
Hello, thanks for inviting me.
You will be telling us about the astrobiological and astrophysical research about Mars and conducted by NASA today.
Yeah, indeed. I'm an astrobiologist with a PhD in physics and working at NASA since 16 years now, actually. And I'm involved in research about enabling life on Mars because that idea has been around for a long time, actually. So you can already see that people are making movies about it. And the astroscience community has actually come up with a name for this, which is called terraforming, and that actually designs all the ideas and concepts of making the hostile environment of Mars to a more Earth-like and habitable planet through planetary engineering. And yeah, why you would do such a thing is actually what you already mentioned a little bit, that you're concerned about resource use or depletion on Earth, and that you want to decrease the chances of humanity's extinction. But yeah, now you might wonder why exactly Mars for this terraforming.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, to our current knowledge, that's what. To our current knowledge, well, I should maybe take a longer break. Okay. To our current knowledge. Okay, I can do this. To our current knowledge, Mars is one of the most Earth-like planets in the Milky Way, in terms of its properties, because there's a presence of water, even if it's frozen, and it has a geological history that suggests that it also once had an atmosphere a little bit like the one on Earth. So that's something we know about Mars. And we also know that terraforming on Mars would entail three major changes. So building up the magnetosphere, building up the atmosphere, and raising the temperature. And if you want to address those three aspects, that's very interlinked. So by addressing one, you might also help addressing the others. And I will tell you more about it because my expertise allows me to offer some solutions in this regard.
Well, thank you. That definitely sounds like you know what you're talking about. So before diving deeper into these three spheres, I would first like to... definitely sounds like you know what you're talking about. But before diving into the three spheres that you just mentioned, I was wondering why you would describe Mars as hostile.
Yeah, that's actually a very good question. Because it's not intuitive to everyone. First, there's low gravity compared to Earth and lower pressure. So you know the pressure at the sea level on Earth, and at Mars it's 1% of this pressure. So that's very, very low, and it's too low for humans to live. For example, for breathing, you need a certain amount of air pressure. There's also lower light levels relative to Earth, which makes plant growth hard, of course, because they're dependent on light. And the lower light levels are one reason for the low temperatures, because actually the annual mean temperatures on Mars are minus 55 degrees Celsius. So that's actually kind of as cold as it gets on the Earth's poles in winter. So it's extremely cold. And it's also why a lot of water on Mars is frozen. And there's no magnetic field around the Mars, which exists around the Earth, and I don't know if you know what it is, but it protects the Earth or any planet that has a magnetic field from solar winds, which are toxic to human beings, or in general wipe away a lot of things that are around the planet. So it's crucial if humans want to live there. And besides this, so that's already quite a lot of inconveniences for humans, but there's also regular Martian dust storms that cover the surface of the whole planet with large layers of light-colored and dense dust, and that can block the surface from sunlight for a month or more. So if you would live there and you're blocked from sunlight for a month, I think that's pretty inconvenient. And then the atmosphere is partly toxic, and there's also no ozone layer, so the surface is exposed to ultraviolet light, which can cause cancer to humans. It's not a very cozy environment.
No, I wouldn't say it's very welcoming. A bit scary, to be honest. But are there any solutions for these circumstances? Because like this, I would definitely not go there.
There's, for example, we conducted experiments to establish a magnetic field, like an artificial magnetic field. But there has been one before on Mars. Billions of years ago, there was one that shielded the planet from solar winds. And back then, there was also an atmosphere around Mars and liquid water. And also much higher temperatures because the magnetic shield protected the atmosphere from being wiped away by the solar storms. But about 4.2 billion years ago, this magnetic field slowly weakened and then died out. And the atmosphere at this time then was striped away the next 500 million years. So status quo is there is none. So that means that if humans want to colonize the planet, one of the first things, or if maybe really the first thing they need to do, is to establish a magnetic field. Otherwise, any artificial atmosphere or plants, surface water, oxygen, whatever humans would construct there would be wiped away. So that's why we developed the idea of a large magnetic shield that consists of a large dipole, so that's a magnet. So that would be a closed electric circuit that is powerful enough to generate an artificial magnetic field, because you can create a magnet through electromagnetic circuits. And that would orbit around Mars in the right position to stand always between Mars and the Sun at any time. And that is a very challenging thing behind it, to keep it in the right position. And this protection would entail a significant change in the climate on Mars and enable potential establishment of an atmosphere or other man-made constructions.
Wow, this is really awesome, but it sounds so complex. But it's so... if I understand correctly, the magnetic field will enable us to build on the planet both natural and man-made elements. But isn't it important that oxygen is present? Like, otherwise it won't even, the magnetic field won't even be necessary. So how can we create this atmosphere?
Yeah, that's also a very good one. But yeah, so I would still say first it's a magnetic field, because otherwise, even if you produced oxygen, it would be wiped away. But the second step would indeed be to manage your atmosphere, because there's also a problem regarding the thickness of the atmosphere. It will increase if there's a magnetic field, because there's less atmosphere swept away, but there's still a problem of the density and of its pressure. Because the planet is just smaller, so it has a lower gravitational force, so it can't hold gases as tightly around it. And that's a problem I don't think we can manage. And if there's not enough pressure, we can't breathe it in. And also for temperature regulation issues, there is no way around either living in caves underground or to establish a dome, in our opinion, or at as far as we got in our findings. I will explain this idea of the dome later. But even if you have a dome or caves, there's still toxic air in it. So you would indeed try ways to produce oxygen. And yeah, there's actually a specific strain of cyanobacteria that seems to be a key solution. And they can also grow with local ingredients. And that has been discovered by one of my astrobiologist colleagues, which is a Frenchman called Cyprien Verceux, and he's at the CERM, that's a research institute in astrobiology and astrophysics at the University of Bremen in Germany, and he has conducted in-depth research into this topic. And he found this cyanobacteria, and he says it could be the initial source of oxygen on Mars. And it's an algae that actually exists here on Earth, and it's one of the oldest living organisms on our planet and adapts very well to many extreme conditions. I mean, if they can go to Mars, then they're very well adapted. And they can also be found in lakes in summer, but they can be toxic for humans if in too high concentrations. He also found that those bacteria can grow excellently in an atmosphere similar to Mars, both in terms of gases and in terms of atmospheric pressure. So yeah, they can use local materials and be the first step to developing soil, but the most important thing is that they do photosynthesis, so they produce oxygen. And if that is combined with artificial light, warmer temperatures, and the potential dome, and suitable nutrients, then you could even enable plant growth which is essential for agriculture and food supply.
Oh, well, this definitely, again, answers my question. It's very detailed. You're very, very good in answering my questions. But I, again, have a different question when I listen to you, because you mentioned that you need warmer temperatures, and I thought Mars was quite cold, so this still doesn't really add up for me. So could you maybe explain how this can be managed?
Yeah, that's a very, very good one as well. The dome would indeed be extremely important for many aspects. But for us, the first challenge was to find a material that would even be suitable for this purpose. Because we needed to find materials strong enough to resist the external pressures and the dust storms. The material also needed to block hazardous and ultraviolet light. We needed a dome that keeps the heat and gases inside but lets sunlight through in order for cyanobacteria or plants at the surface to grow, and maybe even to element potential solar panels if we would use them. And yeah, actually there has been found a material by the NASA Jet Propulsion Lab at Harvard University, which collaborated with University of Edinburgh, and this material is called silica aerogel, which is a material that already exists on Earth, and it's the most insulating material and like that we ever invented. And it's also used in several engineering applications, for example, NASA Mars exploration rovers. So we have experience of this material in space. And we know that a dome with a 3 centimeter thick layer of this material would be able to mimic the Earth's atmospheric greenhouse effect, which is precisely what we also want to warm up what is under the dome. And it also wouldn't require large amounts of energy or maintenance to keep an area warm over longer periods under the dome. So if you manage to increase the temperatures with this dome, then you would also have permanently liquid and accessible water under it. So the dome would already by itself mimic the greenhouse effect, but if you wanted to increase the warming process, because the natural one takes a very long time, you could accelerate it by artificially releasing CO2, for example by burning, or releasing perfluorocarbon gases, which have a bit of a higher greenhouse potential, so they warm quicker than CO2. And they are both gases that stay very long in the atmosphere. So you could add those to initially warm the Mars quicker, so we can go there more quickly. And you could also increase even more by using albedo forces or effects. So I don't know if everyone knows what it is. It means that if light surfaces generally reflect more heat waves and light, so they warm up less quickly, while darker surfaces warm up more quickly and will also, or no, they don't warm up more quickly, but they store heat, so they warm up their surrounding. So if we wanted to increase the heat on Mars, we were thinking of using dark dust from the moons of Mars to spread it under the dome over the surface of the territory, or even over the whole planet, to increase average temperatures. That's the basic idea. And another beneficial thing is, if the dome is very well fixed to the surface, it would also protect the people inside from the dust storms, which we mentioned before. But these storms would also cover the dome with the dust, so then there would be a necessity for cleaning action, so people that actually go out in astronaut suits and clean the dome, otherwise there's not going to be any sunlight passing through, but the dust would still cover the rest of the planet, so there we would also, and that would cool the other parts of the planet where there is no dome, So that would decrease the average temperature of the planet, which might impact the temperature inside of the dome. So there we would also maybe spread dust of the moon's dark dust over the rest of the planet. Yeah, that's the idea.
Thanks a lot. It's really amazing. It keeps amazing me what we can do with technology, but I'm a bit... I wouldn't want to have the job of having to clean the dome outside. But let's go to the next person. Thanks a lot, Juliet. I think you really laid the basics out for how we can live on Mars. And now we can go on to a different aspect, which is also...
Sorry, I think...
Well, thank you, Juliet. This was really amazing. I think you can really... You really know what you're talking about, and it really amazes me what we can do as humans with technology. But I wouldn't want to have the job of cleaning the dome. It would scare me to death, to be honest. But thanks again. You really laid the basics for how we can live on Earth and how we can make it more inhabitable. I think now we can go on to the next person. Our next speaker is Sarah. You specialize in acrobiology and are currently working for NASA as well. Just as Juliet. Can you please introduce yourself and also your research topic?
Well, hi. Thank you for having me in this podcast. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Sarah, and I am an astrobiologist, but also agrobiologist at NASA. And I'm currently overseeing multiple projects that are centered around the possibility of agriculture on Mars. So for today, I will be talking to you about establishing greenhouses and algae farms on Mars, as well as how the resources on Mars can be utilized for agriculture. So as many of you know, greenhouses and other artificial farming structures have enabled humanity to expand food production in otherwise non-fruitful terrains, temperatures, and seasons. They have also played a very big part in the Green Revolution and have enabled food production to really boom. So building a greenhouse on the surface of Mars comes with its own challenges, and it might even not be possible and more favorable to do so underground.
Well, that is quite the opposite from what we do on Earth, but would you say this is due to the low temperatures in Mars, or why do you think this would be necessary?
Well, yeah, for sure, the temperatures definitely play quite a big role, since the plants found on Earth cannot thrive in temperatures of minus 50 to 55 degrees Celsius, as Juliet explained earlier. So a lot of energy would be required to increase the temperature in greenhouses, and, you know, farming underground may be a very good alternative because less heat is lost to the outside, and, well, I guess also the factor of lighting plays a quite important role. Mars receives significantly less sunlight than Earth, so less than 50% of what plants on Earth are exposed to. Therefore, artificial lighting would be necessary above or below ground. And then also solar radiation, so the light that is received on Mars poses another problem, since Mars doesn't have an ozone layer, as was previously mentioned. So the protective glass panels, or the dome, of the greenhouses that are built on the surface would require a special type of glass that removes the radiation. So yeah, I guess that the idea of creating a dome, like Juliet explained earlier, would definitely solve some of these problems. The surface area of Mars is also much lower. The surface area on Mars is much lower than on Earth. So there might be less space available. So in that case, vertical farming, either above or preferably underground, would also be an excellent option.
One second.
I think you should talk a bit more slow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did I hear correctly that you said 50% less sunlight? I need to pack my bronzer then, because when I'm moving to Mars, I will need my tan. And this will not be coming from the sun. Definitely an important issue to keep in mind when moving to Mars, folks. I'm not even sure if I'm able to live with this little sunlight, let alone the plants that are dependent on sunlight. What kind of crops would be feasible even under these circumstances to make?
Well,
form?
Well, I guess, yeah, light is definitely limited, and energy costs should remain as low as possible, so therefore only very energy efficient plants that do not require a lot of sunlight would be plausible to cultivate. So legumes, corn, tomatoes, carrots, and potatoes are all examples of vegetables that are too light intensive. However, better options would be lettuce, spinach, peas, garlic, kale, onions, and sweet potatoes. Dandelions, we've actually found that dandelions also make an excellent option because they grow relatively quickly, and all parts of the plant can be used. So if you like any of these vegetables or are a dandelion fanatic, then Mars is the best place for you. One thing about Mars is that the days are almost as long as they are on Earth. So the circadian rhythms of plants as well as humans, and the circadian rhythm is basically when your metabolism or the plant's metabolism adapts to a certain photoperiod, which is the length of day. But thankfully, this is not too much of a problem because the days on Mars are almost as long as they are on Earth, so the plants wouldn't be significantly impacted by that.
Well, I have to say, not being able to get a tan, popcorn and fries does not make me excited to move. But it does sound very healthy, though. But Juliette mentioned that some sort of algaes. Do you think that these may be valuable to be farmed on Mars? And if so, how do you think this would work?
So we have conducted various experiments to determine how the conditions on Mars could impact algae and other microorganisms, and also how genetic engineering may help us modify them to our advantage. So using cyanobacteria that Juliette also talked about to increase oxygen levels was already discussed, and it's very promising. However, they might also be able to be used as biofuel alongside with algae and also as a food source. This, however, could also cause some social issues as the biomass needs to be rationed between the food sector and the transportation sector. But in general, algae are very good food sources because they contain high amounts of protein. However, this can also be problematic because if we as humans consume too much protein, that would also be harmful. So, yeah, it's important to find species that have a good balance, so not too many proteins, but also enough other essential nutrients. And these may also be obtained through genetic engineering. And because bacteria produce and algae produce are certain oils, and if we engineer them in a certain way to produce vitamins, such as vitamin A, then this would be very beneficial.
Food. That's awesome. But I was thinking, in high school and during my studies, I always learned that plants need nutrients to grow and also that they take up these nutrients and sort of eat these nutrients, and so they will disappear from the ground. But considering that Mars doesn't really have a lot of resources, how do you think, or how will we ensure that the ground keeps these nutrients and so we will keep being able to grow these plants?
That's a pretty good point, actually. So in order to ensure that no nutrients are lost, it would be necessary to establish some sort of nutrient cycle like we have here on Earth. And this can be done by recycling nutrients from human feces, which some people might have a problem with, but it's a very effective method.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, it does sound scientifically very interesting, but it is definitely not what I imagined.
Oh yeah, it is very interesting and useful. And I guess, you know, it's part of the natural nutrient cycle, so if we want to create a semi-natural environment, we would have to include that recycling of nutrients somehow. And this environment would include different types of microorganisms. And it would allow the populations to remain stable if we have a natural cycle going. And then we will have sustainable crop yields. So when first arriving on Mars, it's very essential to reduce the weight of the resources that we are taking along, because for every gram, you need a certain amount of fuel, which is very expensive. So this means that we also have to, you know, very efficiently utilize the resources that are already present on Mars. So there's actually no proper soil on Mars, only a substrate called regolith. and is composed solely of mineral particles because soil holds organic matter, but that isn't found on Mars. So unfortunately, regolith also includes a toxic substance called perchlorate, which is found in abundance on Mars. And it also, we've done some experiments and it has inhibited plant growth and can also be lethal to humans when it bioaccumulates in plants, or when it accumulates in plants. And it can only be removed through intensive rinsing using chemicals or through perchlorate reducing bacteria, but those still have to be genetically engineered, and that's quite a complicated process. And furthermore, salt, metal, and iron oxide levels, and iron oxide is what makes Mars so red, fun fact, but those three conditions also pose problems because, they need to be altered to make the terrain favorable for Earth's plants. And furthermore, plants can't grow without organic matter. It's a very important compound of soil, so that needs to be added as well. And here on Earth, we have so-called bioturbators. Okay, here on Earth, we have a process which is called bioturbation, and it's essentially when organisms living in and moving through the soil mix the different soil levels and the nutrients, but they also increase the availability of oxygen and other gases because they create hollow spaces between the soil particles. And this would be very essential to also include in the soil on Mars because it just it makes the soil much more favorable for plants.
Okay, is that all we need to be able to grow crops on Mars, or are there any other things that we need to include?
Well, no, there's a lot of factors that need to be met, but we also, a very important nutrients that plant needs and that plants need is nitrogen, and nitrogen-fixing bacteria, which exist around the roots of some plants here on Earth and are already being used to make nitrogen more available in the soil, should also be added to the soil on Mars, in symbiosis with some plants. As this would make the atmospheric nitrogen, which is available in Mars's atmosphere, available for crops. So in order to successfully grow crops, we also, alongside nitrogen, we also need phosphorus and potassium. And if one of these requirements is not met, then growth is stunted because metabolic processes cannot take place. So photosynthesis, respiration, growth, transpiration, all those essential plant processes can take place if one of the nutrients is in a shortage. So this makes growing plants in space and on Mars extremely complex because you need to meet all of the conditions for the plants to grow successfully. So, one pro for Mars is that there's a reduced gravitational force, which means that less water is required for the crops because it is lost by draining much, much more slowly than on Earth. Yeah, but all in all, agriculture on Mars would come with many complexities. However, we have already made profound progress during the past years, and although there are still certain gray areas that need to be explored and various scenarios that we need to go through, things are definitely going in the right direction. And yeah, I believe that learning more about how we can inhabit Earth and start to grow crops from zero on, it can really help us face future challenges and current challenges here on Earth.
Well, thank you, Sarah. Those were very good answers. I never really realized how many processes and things are needed for growing food, so this definitely made me appreciate the crops on Earth way more. Thank you again. Now we can go on to the next guest. Shall we stop for a minute?
Okay.
Okay, then on to our next guest. Liz, can you please introduce yourself?
Of course, Claire. Hello, my name is Liz, and I'm working in the field of architectural design, and I'm specialized in the special conditions that the planet Mars has to offer to us. And so I'm currently working on a project that explores the self-sufficient and sustainable living on Mars. And one of the main challenges that we encounter while doing this is the building materials and the structure of these designs and buildings, as this will be the most tricky task, in my opinion at least, for the first settlers that arrive on Mars. But we have also heard about a lot of other challenges that the first settlers may have to encounter. This is one additional one. Also due to the fact that the planet is exposed to high radiation and intense cold, and we need to provide, therefore, a thick shield for radiation, but have only to use the local materials, as the others also already mentioned. And in order to do that, we can either provide houses that are above the surface, or we can build kind of half above, half below the surface, and that could, for example, to shield for the solar radiation and for the very first settlers, so before we can establish a dome or whatever we might come up with. We could, for example, create a 30 centimeters thick layer that contains water, that's kind of like a shell around the outside walls of the construction. However, that would allow really, really low sunlight levels, also as the levels of sunlight is already quite low. And therefore, the other idea is to, and also due to other reasons, is that the housing could be located under the surface. But that then shouldn't be like dark caves, as we also have to grow plants, like Sarah already established. But we could have kind of like holes in the surface that then allow some light to come in, and we could also work, for example, with mirrors, as we can also produce glass with the materials that we have on Mars. And then try to concentrate the light a bit more, and then hopefully also cultivate food with that. And rather the first settlers' houses. So as soon as they arrive, or even beforehand, we will have to start altering the atmosphere, like she had already said. But in combination with this dome, all these protections and alterations of the atmosphere, we can then think about more comfortable living spaces. But that's a bit more in the later stages of the mass colonization. The projects that I rather work in, they are more the first settlements. So really, really basic, really, one would say quite primitive. That's what the first settlers will encounter. And for the local materials, how we could start building with the local materials that are there, we have enough rovers and probes that were sent to Earth, have revealed enough about the geology, and so we can start figuring out which exact materials we will work, but I won't bore you with unnecessary details. But for example, there's enough material that we could build glass, and some sort of windows therefore might actually be possible at some stage. And also there's a lot of ceramics, which are clay-like material that we on Earth, for example, use to make bricks.
Oh, but that then sounds like we will have houses built from bricks, or am I understanding that wrong?
Not really, but it would be quite funny imagining red brick stone houses on the red planet. We would use that material probably, but the most current plans are involving 3D printing. So, we will kind of explain that. We will kind of 3D print layer by layer the shape of the houses. So we will have to send machines up there, and then with local materials melt them or mix them together so they can 3D print. And then we can imagine something like spacey designs and aerodynamic shapes with these little lines from 3D printing. The designs look more like really funny, actually, like jars or like eggs that are like either laying or standing. Or some designs also include something like spider nets or similar floors that are woven by the robots. And they would then connect the different levels and. This 3D printing technique also prevents any waste that the building sector could make, as the old material can relatively easily be melted and then be reused. So also these first settlements, for example, they would then not just be dumped when later stages come, but can easily be reused. And also, this is very important as we don't really have many resources on Mars. And also, we don't want to continue the mistakes that we were doing on Earth. Wasting a lot of materials and being quite unsustainable. But yeah, so all in all, the first designs keep coming in, and I'm very much looking forward to see which ones will prove to be the best. But I think it's really important, or really interesting, to learn something from these designs too for us here on Earth, as these very diverse ideas and rethinking living space and making them energetically, spatially efficient and practical for most important. Makes it personally also for me really interesting to see how these constructions are 100% circular and really working within resource scarceness. So I'm very interested what the Earth's population here and now will do with these ideas, and maybe they will take up on that a bit. But maybe NASA and some other space agencies will one day send robots to 3D print their constructions, their cities layer, and then maybe
cool.
We'll go there someday.
I actually hope that they will 3D print a building here on Earth. I think it would really be cool to have these weird shapes here in the skylines of our cities.
Would look quite nice.
Yeah. But Liz, can you maybe tell more on what this will all mean for the people that will live there in the end?
That's something I think that also the listeners can think about very well. A ticket to Mars is a one-way ticket, so you leave everything and everyone on Earth behind, and you know you will never ever come back and never ever see them again. And it's a really, really tough thing to decide and to go through. So imagine if you had to live the rest of your life on Mars, what would you miss the most? Like, for example, I would miss the green or the interaction with a wide variety of people you meet. And so all in all, we have to figure out how we could provide comfortably living space on Mars, and how can we replace, for example, the sensation of sunshine on your face or the grass beneath your feet. We in our agency want to ensure that the people that go there for the rest of their lives have the best possible living conditions.
Yeah, that's of course very important. I would also miss the green very much, but I think I would really need some me time, because I imagine that it's all very close together. So when I think about spending the every day with the same few people, I don't want to think about that.
Yes, indeed. Very well phrased. Indeed, the need for privacy and personal space in such a small living space is critical. And this is an issue already experienced in those living in small habitats here on Earth and small living spaces. We take quite some research actually and input from refugee camps and other smaller living conditions in urban areas, where personal space is already a huge problem. And even though other conditions like hygienic conditions and food would probably be way better compared to in refugee camps, but you can imagine how it would be when you're additionally billions of kilometers away from your beloved ones and will probably also never see them again. So yes, also a safe haven is really key for the construction of these houses there.
Yeah, I imagine those. I don't want to live in a refugee camp. That doesn't sound very attracting to me, but thanks a lot. It was really interesting. I really hope that we can see some of these ideas already implemented on Earth. I think that would be very interesting. I think now we can go on to our last speaker. Thank you, Liz. This definitely answers my question again. And yeah, indeed, the living conditions in refugee camps are horrible, and I really don't want to wish those upon anyone. So I'm really glad that we can think about it in this way. And I really hope that we can see some of those constructions on Earth someday. I think those would be really cool, and I would actually really like to sort of live in those, maybe not forever, but to try it. Thank you. I think now we can go on to the last expert and speaker. Leon, welcome. You're going to talk about socio-economic processes. Could you maybe introduce yourself a little bit?
Okay, then Leon, welcome. You're going to talk to us about some socio-economic challenges. Please introduce yourself. The floor is yours.
Hi, yeah, as you said, yeah, I'm Leon. Thank you very much for having me. And it's definitely an interesting topic you chose, so I'm excited to talk about it. Yeah, as you said, my research is mainly in socioeconomic challenges and everything related to that, so society, and also specifically about postmodern growth theories, so which is in general very unrelated to astronomy, but I hope I can still contribute with some useful insights into this discussion.
Yeah, I'm sure you will. So first of all, your discipline and Mars don't really go together. And I also really don't think that many will think about social sciences when thinking about colonizing Mars, but more about the physics, natural sciences, and the space shuttles and technology and all. So why do you think it's also important to talk about society and not about the sheer, because it isn't really about the sheer survival in the beginning, I think.
Yeah, for sure, that's a good point. I definitely agree. I think most people would probably not think about my discipline when talking about colonizing Mars. But still, like at the one hand, you talk about the human material relationship that my colleagues just so well talked about. So that's about like how humans interact with the new environment and meet their physiological needs. But then at the same time, we can also consider the human-human relationships. So how do humans organize among each other? What should be their goal, or maybe better, what should they strive for? What are the values that are the basis of their society, basically? So the paradigms too, collection of values. And how will these communities and societies in the end look like? And of course, there are multiple answers to these questions. You cannot standardize this in any way. And these answers will not be undisputed or objective or easy to test in any way, such as the scientific aspects in this podcast are. So it's sort of this classic social science, natural science divide. But still, that doesn't make social science any less important. And basically, societies can collapse because of social factors, or they can thrive. So social factors and are critical for an intact society. And you can look at aspects like social safety and social security, which are very important. And they're also part of the bottom of the pyramid of human needs, which you might have seen already. So on the bottom, there are the physiological needs, but also just above that are social safety and social security, and they also belong to the very basic needs that humans have. So yeah, that's why it's just very critical to also just look at social factors, and also at the same time, you cannot talk about technology without the human aspects, because technology is made by humans for humans, so you should also analyze that.
Yeah, good point. I never really thought about it in that way, but when you say it like that, it does make very good, yeah, it really does make sense. So what do you think, or what is important when setting up such an extraterrestrial society? What is important in the social sciences?
Oh yeah, good and also very big question. I'd say, generally speaking, it's the most important that we as humans learn from the mistakes that we have made on Earth, because like that's our only point of reference or comparison that we have, and our only source of information, therefore. So we have to learn from terrestrial history in general.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's a shame that the realization of mistakes often comes way too late. But yeah, that's why there are mistakes. What do you think the most important mistake that we made here on Earth or are making, we don't know yet, is that we should not, that we should learn from or shouldn't repeat if we were to go to Mars?
Oof, yeah, also a tough one. Yeah, in my opinion, the most fundamental attitude that we should first unlearn before we can learn new attitudes, that one is sort of this obsessive form of competitions that like humans tend to strive for or organize in. So we should learn that humans are a social species and that our survival and our thriving is much more likely if our core values are based on collaboration instead of competition, which is especially the case for such a novel and also hostile environment such as the planet of Mars is. Yeah, so like our current central paradigms on Earth are largely based on competition, and this is a means to growth. So they're like the tangible manifestations of this are currently present in capitalism or neoliberalism, which is dominant on Earth. And as you probably know, we see where this has led us right now. So we see how this has divided global society, global inequality is increasing, and also brought the planet to the brink of ecological collapse. So resources are depleted, ecosystems are degraded, and the climate significantly altered. So like going about this in the same way on Mars, on this new planet, that already exposes us to dire resource scarcity and a hostile climate system, which is not adaptable to humans or compatible with humans in a way, that would be catastrophic in the end, in my opinion. So therefore, that's why we think in our institute that we need a paradigm shift that is worthy of the large undertaking this will be anyways. So first we need basic values of collaboration, compassion, and sharing instead of competition and exclusion. And also what we believe would be beneficial would be a sense of sufficiency instead of this infinite growth assumption that is present here on Earth. But of course, also if you think about it, human settling Mars, first you need some form of growth, right? Because you want to survive on this planet, you want to set up everything, you want to set up the infrastructure and the economy that can ensure first survival, but then also prosperity at some point, a certain quality of living. But in the end, we really have to take care also that planetary limits cannot be exceeded. That's the case on Earth and also on Mars. Because in the end, then we will end up in the same soup as we are in right now. And yeah, it will be hard for settlers to find another escape planet to go to, which is close by. So the challenge really is to achieve a certain degree of growth, which is then powered by collaboration instead of competition, while adhering to these planetary limits at the same time. And yeah, this is a big challenge, of course. But I believe since this is a what-if format, and the whole scenario is very futuristic, as you said, anyways, I believe it's also very appropriate to be a little ambitious and also utopian for that matter.
Yeah, I think so too. Of course, this is very interesting, but I think it sounds so easy to achieve, but it actually will be such a big change. But it also, what you just said, illustrates the importance of social sciences for achieving success in a sustainable way. And although I would really enjoy and encourage this way of thinking and leaving behind the competition and everything, I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I also think this is very difficult to reach, even though, like, if you say it like this, it does sound quite easy to just leave behind this mindset. But then I think that this mindset is very ingrained in the current human society. So let's be a bit pessimistic and think that this paradigm won't ever change. And we just settle in the status quo of what we have now with this attitude. So what do you then think that would happen?
Yeah, that's definitely a valid concern for this matter. I believe we will have in the end get similar problems, but maybe they will be even more intense. So at first, because resources are so immensely scarce, it is even easier to exclude people from them, and that will result in extreme inequality, so power differences within the society, which will definitely not be sustainable. And also not only looking from the already very convincing ethical standpoint, which is that it's wrong to exclude people and because of any factors. It is also that the society in general would be very much less viable or resistant. And for example, like social unrest and conflict could result from this extreme inequality. Well, just in general, these ideologies of social Darwinism have to be avoided at all costs, because that would be very dangerous. So social Darwinism is translating the Darwin's biological concepts into society. So his concepts like natural selection and survival of the fittest, to apply that to society and economy and sort of justify a way of doing. So in this view, humanity is naturally divided into the strong and fit, who then are rewarded and thrive, and on the other hand, the weak and unfit, who are punished and die. And this is sort of justified as the natural way, which is, of course, very problematic. And also, this paradigm has been found to power, among others, the laissez-faire capitalism and nationalism, and also fascism. So yeah, again, like just the values and paradigms are very critical about how we do this, and also then determine the survival.
Yeah, not a very happy outcome, but this is also very pessimistic. So I think, or at least I hope, that humans are smart enough to realize that this sort of thinking does not and did not work on Earth. And let's hope that they realize that it should not be repeated on Mars. Do you think there are any other specific things we should do, or when we could design and organize this society?
Yes, for sure. So there are many different ideas. But one idea that's already being discussed here on Earth, and it could also be of interest for Mars, is the universal basic income, which means that all citizens will be provided with the means to meet their basic needs, which would be then in the form of regular payments, either in currency or goods. And it is making sure that everybody can meet their basic human needs, such as food, water, and shelter. So in this case, there will, for example, be no housing market, because basic needs would not be privatized and made profit of. But yeah, in general, just the question of government and economy will be central to how the society will be structured. So what kind of government would or should there be? And there are very different answers to this question again. So like more radical ideas include the notion of no government at all, so an anarchistic society, which is then fully organized around strong shared values and social acceptance principles. And for example, in that case, there could be no money, but a voluntary economy supplying the needed products and services without the existence of other commodity goods. That's a scenario, for example, a very radical one in that case. But it's also great. It just leaves a lot of space for thought. And you can experiment a lot also about the ethical implications of all this. And yeah, I believe,
okay, thanks a lot. Those, I definitely realize now why social sciences are so important. It also, I think it should be more known that this is such a basic necessity for the survival of humanity. I think it's not emphasized enough how important social sciences are. But thank you again, it was very informative. Well, we have now had all four experts. I think it was very informative, and I think I'm quite impressed actually with all the knowledge that has already been gathered without ever going to Mars. And it looks like we can already move there tomorrow by what we have here, heard here. Although I'm not quite sure if I would choose the farming in poop, a little sunlight, and the possibility of a perch scenario over my current situation with my comfortable cozy house, a good tan, and organized government. But let's not thunder at this. I hope this has given some, although we have not really answered the questions, but I think we have given some fun perspectives and concept for us, and I hope you can all reminisce about this and have some good sessions with yourself on how you want to approach these. Okay, so thank you, that was it for today. So although we have tried to give an answer to how we as humanity could move to Mars, the future is always uncertain. I mean, thus cannot provide a definite answer for this scenario. But who is even to say that we will ever be needing this knowledge? And would it even be, could it even be considered a serious solution for the current unsustainable practice on Earth? Those questions may be very fun to still think about. It may still be useful and of course fun to develop the knowledge and technologies which may make this transition possible. So maybe this apocalyptic scenario will never occur, but humanity might still explore Mars just for fun. This would of course bring other questions with it, such as, do humans have the right to take ownership of another planet, or is it ethical to decide for future generations to move on to a resource scarce and possibly dangerous planet? And next to the technological aspects of moving to Mars, we must of course not forget the societal aspects which need to be considered. Leon discussed it very good. So should the Martian society have a government, and how should this be governed, or should there be no government? This may all be very fun to think about in a different podcast or just for yourself. But for now, let's say that this apocalyptic scenario may be actually a possibility, which is of course very interesting to think about, and of course may definitely inspire some awesome fictional books. But all in all, let's hope humanity will never have to go through such events. However, maybe, just maybe, to be 100% sure that we do have a safety net in case this apocalypse does occur, let's silently thank Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos on spending their abundant money on this topic. But for now, the most relevant question for you may be, would you be willing to live on Mars? Thank you.